in your kitchen because it'll be good for you and you'll end up enjoying yourself. That's not quite as catchy, but it's one of the themes in his new book titled Cooked. The book is about what happens between growing food and eating food, and it's divided into four chapters: fire, water, air, and earth. Michael Pollan has written a number of best-selling books about the downside of the country's industrialized food system and its impact on eating choices, eating habits, and health. He is the Knight Professor of Journalism at Berkeley, and he joins us here in our Philadelphia studios. And Michael Pollan, nice to have you back with us on Radio Times.
Thank you, Marty. Good to be back.
Well, it's interesting that you have written about growing food, you've written about eating food, and now you're writing about cooking food. Was that the piece that was missing for you?
As it turned out, I didn't realize it when I set out. I don't kind of plan my books very carefully, but I started out writing about the food chain, and you know, Omnivore's Dilemma is really a story about where your food is grown and how it's produced. And then I leapt ahead because everybody was saying, well, what about health? What about health? And I took a look at the body end of the food chain. You know, what happens after we ingest this stuff? What does it do to our health? Why do we suffer from so much chronic disease and obesity? And along the way, I kept bumping into cooking or the lack thereof as having a profound impact on both ends of the food chain. So that the reason that we've industrialized our agriculture and moved to these giant monocultures, whether of corn and soy or animal factories, is really because fast food has been driving those kind of changes. The industrialization of our eating is leading to the industrialization of our growing of food. And so I realized, oh, that's interesting. You kind of have to pay attention to the eating and not just the farming. And then when I was working on the nutrient question, what should you eat, mm-hmm. It gradually became clear that it really didn't matter what nutrients you ate. What mattered most is a human doing your cooking or a corporation? And if a corporation's cooking for you, odds are you're eating the wrong stuff and you're eating too much of it and you're going to have problems with chronic disease and all the dietary problems we're seeing.
Yeah, and you're also describing a kind of food haves and have-nots because on the one hand, yes, we eat out much more than we used to. We eat a lot of fast food that we didn't used to do. But we also, for many people, and this is probably more middle class and upper middle class people, have nice kitchens full of, mixers and specialized dishwashers. Yeah. It's a sort of a weird dichotomy when it comes
paradox.
To food.
We're kind of obsessed with cooking. And it's true. Lots of rich people have these show kitchens, which they barely use, but it's an important status symbol. And we also watch lots of cooking on television. And there are millions of Americans who are spending more minutes in the day watching other people cook food on television than they are spending cooking it themselves.
Really? Yeah.
Well, the average American is spending 27 minutes a day cooking. One episode of a Food Network show gets you over that. And many people watch several at once. So that, in a way, was a paradox that got me thinking about this whole question. If we decided to outsource cooking, like so many other things in modern life, to corporations, why are we looking back? Why don't we just – I mean, we outsource changing the oil in your car. We outsource sewing your clothing. There's so many things we don't do ourselves anymore, and we haven't looked back. Cooking's different. Mm. And I was kind of curious to unpack that and figure out why. Why is cooking different? And I think partly because it goes really deep into who we are. We all have really warm memories of being in the kitchen as kids. Whether it was our mother or our grandmother, and the smells and the transformations that take place, the alchemy, and then this gift of the home cooked food prepared by someone who loves you. And I think we're not quite prepared to let it go. Even those of us who feel we don't have time or we don't have skills.
In fact, you write about your mother being a good cook.
I was very lucky.
And cooked pretty regularly.
Yeah, and ambitiously. Family. She would watch Julia Child and then try to make it. And we would have
whacking those chickens.
Yeah,
right?
She would do all that stuff. And we would have boeuf bourguignon or coq au vin. And, these were weeknight meals for the kids. It was kind of remarkable. I didn't appreciate it until much later.
Of course.
But we also had our share of junk food. I mean, it's not like we were living in Alice Waters' household. I mean, we were, they would go out on the weekends and she'd give us some TV dinners and our frozen pizza, and we loved that, and we would go out sometimes for fast food. But Monday through Friday, we normally had a family dinner.
Well, and it's interesting to think about, I had the same thing, a mother that basically cooked our meals pretty much all the time. But it's interesting to think about what happened to women in the kitchen. You write about the feminist movement and, you know, getting out of the kitchen, going to work, and what happened to cooking under that. I think there was a KFC ad that you include saying.
Yeah, well, the industry basically
tapped into all of that.
Saw what was going on. They recognized that there was this uncomfortable conversation taking place in American kitchens and, you know, dinner tables over this, we need to redo the division of labor in the house because women are working now. It isn't fair that women should still be responsible for all the domestic chores. And in fact, women liked cooking better than all the other domestic chores. The marketers knew this. They saw it as a creative outlet. It wasn't regarded as drudgery.
Than dusting. The
cleaning really was. The laundry was. But the industry leapt in and they saw an opportunity. They'd been trying to get into the American kitchen for 100 years and they'd been rebuffed more or less. But when this tension arose and the feminist revolution came, they stepped forward. And KFC had a billboard that basically captured this marketing genius. It was a big bucket of Kentucky Fried Chicken with two words over it, women's liberation. And they successfully kind of re-described not cooking as a progressive thing to do.
Yeah.
And it worked. And it relieved this tension in the household, and we find, you know, cooking rates dropping by half since 1977, the amount of time and the number of meals that are cooked at home.
Well, it's interesting to think about time because I think everyone feels like they don't have any, and also technology, what technology has offered all of us.
Well, you know, we have a lot of time-saving technologies, but we feel more time pressure than ever. So there's something wrong with this picture. But I'm convinced – I mean, we do have a time problem. There's no question about it. But we have a lot more media making claims on our time. And if you look at how we're spending time, we say we have no time. But in the last 10 years alone, we found 2 hours a day for the internet. Where do we get it? It's still a 24-hour day. Well, we took some of it from television watching. We took some of it probably from cooking. The point is, I think, that if we think something's important, we find the time. We find the time to get to the gym because we know it's really essential to our health and our sanity. And my argument is that cooking is just as important to your health and your sanity. The difference is you can outsource cooking. You can't outsource taking a run or going to the gym. Maybe they'll get to that. So we have this tendency to think if you can outsource something, you should. And our capitalist economy encourages us in that thinking all the time. Let us do it for you because that's how they create new markets. But I argue we need to push them out.
Well, and you also argue that literally by cooking at home, you are – making steps to improve your health. Just the act of cooking
without
at home
question.
Is good for your health.
Yeah. I mean, I've studied nutrition closely for the last couple of years. And based on the research I've read and also based on the uncertainty about nutrients, good and bad, and the changing advice about that, the most important thing you can do for your health is to cook. If you cook, you don't have to worry about nutrients anymore. You don't have to know what an antioxidant is. You're going to cook the right stuff. Corporations cook very differently than human beings do in a couple different ways. First, they shop badly. They buy the cheapest stuff they can find, cheap commodities. Then they dress it up with lots of salt, fat, and sugar to make it bearable and attractive to us.
And we love those tastes.
They do. Yeah, and they're cheap. They're very cheap to provide. Sugar and salt are, you know, incredibly cheap to provide. And then they use lots of additives, really dubious additives, because this stuff was cooked a long time ago and far away, and it has to have a good shelf life. So they're using chemicals to prepare these foods that you would never have in your own pantry. And there are real questions about their health value and their effect on our kids especially. But the other thing about corporate cooking is they cook different kinds of food. They love to cook those labor-intensive foods that are made with cheap, raw ingredients. That's their perfect food. And, of course, the French fry is their best achievement.
I have to give them credit.
One thing they cook well are French fries. And once you cook French fries in a factory, they're so easy to make. But imagine you're a home cook and you're cooking most of your own food. You'll only make French fries once a month, every 2 months. It's really hard and messy. Whereas if you're letting corporations cook, you could have it twice a day. And many, many Americans do eat French fries twice a day. And that's precisely the kinds of foods we're getting in trouble with.
Well, what's interesting about you is that you're not a vegan, you're not a vegetarian, you
are. I'm an omnivore.
You're an omnivore, exactly.
And that includes French fries.
And that includes French fries, and it also includes meat. Your book begins with a trip to a place called the Skylight Inn in Aden, North Carolina, to find out how they make barbecue. And it sounds like it tastes really, really good. What did they do?
It was really good. Well, I was looking for the kind of most unreconstructed cooking there is, the closest thing to that ancient put an animal over the fire and share it experience, right, which is, you know, where cooking begins. And so in the fire section, which is really about the early origins of cooking and recapturing some of that primal magic, I thought, well, whole hog barbecue, which is the specialty of eastern North Carolina, not western. There they do shoulders with a tomato-based sauce. You know, they barbecue always has its rules. Eastern is whole hog, vinegar-based sauce, very little sauce. And so I found a couple pit masters, and I went out to Aden. That was the first place I went. And this place was in the middle of nowhere. It was this really funky building that looked that had a Capitol dome on it for obscure reasons and was called the Skylight Inn but had no skylight. And they were cooking whole hogs in a brick building behind the restaurant that had actually burned down three or four times because, you know, they have to leave the fire running all night and nobody sticks around. And they were slow cooking these pigs, 20 hours each, over wood fire, just smoldering gently, 200 degrees. And the result, and then they would chop it all together. I mean, that's what's unusual about a whole hog barbecue. You're not getting the loin or the shoulder or the belly. You're getting everything chopped together with the crackling. And that's the magic ingredient. It's like these little shards of bacon only begins to suggest how good it is. And they chop it all together, and they put it on a bun, and they mix a little vinegar and pepper with it. And it is. It's an astonishing sandwich.
And it costs $2.75.
Which is amazing. I mean, this is a very democratic slow food when you think about it. However, the only way they can do it that cheaply is by using commodity pork, which is a nasty product in my view. I mean, it comes off of these confinement operations that are essentially destroying agriculture and the environment in eastern North Carolina. And so I felt a little funny celebrating it. They were producing a beautiful sandwich, much cheaper than McDonald's, but it was, in a way, still part of the industrial food chain. It looked traditional, but it wasn't really. And so I looked harder, and I found a pitmaster who actually was using really good sustainable pork in Raleigh, Durham, named Ed Mitchell.
Let's take a very short break, and then we'll get back to our conversation talking with Michael Pollan today on the show. He has a new book. It's called Cooked, A Natural History of Transformation. And we're taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. Stay with us. Call us. We'll be right back.
Supporting WHYY, Glenn Mead, an independent investment and wealth management firm for families, family offices, and endowments and foundations seeking thoughtful advice generation after generation. Details are available from Chip Wilson at 215-419-6100.
WHYY is a media sponsor for the Philadelphia Speaker Series, presented by Widener University, offering its 2013-14 season of diverse ideas, world perspectives, and thought-provoking conversation. 7 engaging evenings at the Kimmel Center with a stellar lineup of speakers, including former Greek Prime Minister George Papandreou, author Bill Bryson, Ambassador John Huntsman, and historian Doris Kearns Goodwin. Information at PhiladelphiaSpeakersSeries.org.
I'm Artie Moss-Cohen. We're in the second day of the spring membership campaign here at WHYY. Have you made a pledge of support yet? Members provide more than half of our funding, and that money supports the programs that you enjoy, like Radio Times. So be more than a listener. Become a supporter by calling 1-888-345-9499 or pledge online at WHYY.org. You know where your money is going because you can hear it every day, all day and night right here at WHYY. Thanks very much.
Pennsylvania Family Support Alliance supports WHYY. April is Child Abuse Prevention Month, and Pennsylvania Family Support Alliance is offering information on how to protect kids at pa-fsa.org.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Artie Moscowane. As you know, Michael Pollan has written a number of best-selling books exploring some of the problems with America's industrialized food system. His new book is about getting back in the kitchen and cooking, and it's called Cooked, A Natural History of Transformation. And we're taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. I do want to get to some of the other people that you met in your education, as you say, in this book. But just to, I guess, complete the chapter. Chapter on barbecue. You did find someone who I guess was.
I did. I found a pitmaster in Raleigh, Durham, named Ed Mitchell, who's a wonderful pitmaster, and he didn't want to use commodity pork, and he wanted to do something to help the farmers of North Carolina who were still growing pork or pigs outside the old-fashioned way and slaughtering them locally. And so he is really committed to making barbecue with really good pigs. Mm. But he has to charge more. And he has to charge – in his
a
last restaurant
more?
Was $9 or $10 a sandwich. Mm. But it's kind of a – I mean his place – his last place had valet parking and a wine list. So
something different establishment.
Yeah,
right?
But I think he's getting back to basics. Mm. He's opening a new restaurant very soon that I'm going to see tomorrow actually. So well, I'll see what he's up to.
But just to underscore a pig farm that you visited, I'm just quoting you here, you do describe it, and I think it's important for listeners to understand this, a porcine hell of stench and shrieking. I mean, it just it sounds like a horror.
Well, confinement hog operations, which are indoors, the animals are penned, the sows are in pens so narrow they can never turn around to make it easier to inseminate them. They all have their tails clipped. To make them more sensitive so that they will shriek when other animals try to cannibalize them because they're going crazy. It is a hell. It's a vision of hell to be in one of these places. And it's very hard, having been in one of those places, to enjoy normal pork. But that's what most pork is. We have alternatives, though, and it's very exciting in the market. And they're more and more, and you can get them at your farmer's market or Nyman pork is raised sustainably. So I wanted to find pitmasters who were sensitive to these issues too.
What about the idea of using technology to come up with meat substitutes that taste good and perhaps are even good for us?
Yeah. Well, there's a couple different initiatives underway. One is to clone muscle they'll take a little sample of muscle from one cow or pig and reproduce it by cloning it in a medium. I think it's kind of a crazy idea. I mean, the first burger is going to be unveiled and tasted in London, I think, this month or next month. And it costs several hundred thousand dollars. Prices will come down.
To taste this or to create it?
Well, to create it. I mean, the science that went into it. And there are other initiatives, though, that I think are more promising. And that is simply on the kind of cheap meats that we eat a lot of, like hamburgers. Hamburger is not a very it's pretty easy to simulate a hamburger. Veggie burgers don't do it yet, but there is one company I know of in on the West Coast that's doing some very sophisticated food science to make a mock meat that would have all the satisfactions of a burger. And they've kind of down to the fact that it starts off pink and turns gray-brown when you cook it and they're doing, interesting fermentation processes actually to create this. They're doing it with cheese too. And you could see something like that replacing the cheese used on pizzas, which is a huge amount of cheese and is undistinguished, even if it comes from cows.
Yeah,
and fast food hamburgers, which, if you actually remove the patty from the roll with the secret sauce and the lettuce, is like really not a very distinguished thing to eat. And so I think we'll see some efforts to replace meat with acceptable substitutes.
Let me ask you about the water chapter. And you had actually she was a student of yours, and then you became a student of hers, an Iranian-American, Samin
Nosrat. Yeah.
And she has worked, I guess, at Chez Panisse.
She trained at Chez Panisse and then had worked in another restaurant. And when I set out to – and she had taken a class I was teaching on food writing a few years ago. And I knew she was a wonderful chef and a great explainer and a great enthusiast. And so when I wanted to do – the second chapter is about water, which is to say cooking in pots, everyday home cooking. And so I asked her if she would teach me and give me lessons. And we set up this kind of biweekly 4-hour session where – and there would be a theme, you know, today we're doing emulsification or the Maillard reaction and whatever it was. And we would cook a whole meal together. And over time, we realized we were producing all this beautiful food and there weren't enough people to eat it. So we started making this a dinner party. And it evolved into something where our friends would come over in the middle to help cook. And it became a very social event. But she was a wonderful teacher. And she taught me how to rethink my perspective on doing things like chopping onions, which I regarded as really not only drudgery but noxious drudgery. And but she's a very philosophical cook and studies yoga seriously, and she kind of explained, you know, the key to cooking well is practice, patience, and presence. Presence is key. And you know, you can look at chopping an onion as drudgery or you can look at it as a Zen practice. And I learned and I live by the saying, when chopping onions, just chop onions. Don't fight it.
And have a very good knife,
and
I have to
very
say.
Sharp, and there's some tricks to keep it from making you cry. And then learn the science of what's going on in an onion to make you cry. I mean, how do they get that tear gas? How does that work? And it's kind of incredible. I mean, if you could get inside an onion without slicing it open, you would find only sweetness. But you would also see, imagine you're at microscopic size, you would see these little balloons floating around. And in those balloons is an enzyme. And when one of those balloons gets pierced, that enzyme goes out into the liquid and divides these chemicals in half, and they turn into sulfuric acid.
Wow.
And chemicals called lacrimators, tear makers. And this is the plant's defense. But we can defeat it if we know all this. With a very sharp knife.
With a very sharp knife. But she kind of underscores, and your book really underscores, the importance of a pot of food. I mean, the idea of creating a whole meal in a pot, whether it's a stew or a soup or a bunch of veggies and whatever thrown in a pot.
Well, it's peasant cooking. It's, as she calls it, grandma cooking. We fetishize it now, but this is how peasants fed themselves with really cheap cuts of meat, which are the best for braising and stewing. They have the most flavor and they respond to long cooking. But you also mix vegetables in. So you're having less meat in your diet, basically. Meat becomes the flavor medium. But a lot of the bulk is vegetables. So it's a very sustainable way to eat on many levels. Plus, there's absolutely no loss of nutrients. You know, whereas if you're grilling, all the fat and lots of nutrients are dripping onto the fire and you're losing them. In a pot, it's all contained. And then you have this miracle of people eating from the same pot, which psychologically is very powerful.
Like a pot in the middle of the table?
Yeah, you put the trivet out and you actually bring the casserole out. And the fragrant steam comes out and people come out of their rooms. They're like, what do I smell? And they gravitate to the table. And I'm convinced when people share food, they find themselves on the same emotional page in a way we never do if we're all getting our
single-serving
entrees.
Well, I like the little detour that you took in this because it harkened back to your mother's Dansk turquoise casserole that she used to use in –
And she still has.
Well, and I can see it. I mean, it's such a sort of memorable looking.
It was an artifact of the 60s of that Scandinavian
especially the turquoise,
modern.
Right?
Yeah, and they still make them. And it's a beautiful thing. And it has a built-in trivet. The handle becomes a trivet. And you turn over the top and put it down. And that, to me, just symbolizes family dinner.
And that's Michael Pollan, our guest today in Radio Times. We are talking about cooking. His new book is called Cooked, A Natural History of Transformation. He has written about how we eat and what we eat and where our food comes from. And we're taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. Let me get a couple of callers in. And it looks like we have Carmen from Swarthmore. And Carmen, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Thank you for your show and for taking the call.
Sure.
So my question for Mike Pollan is, what does he think about macrobiotic cooking and lifestyle and also places that offer cooking classes week-long or longer and hands-on like menu planning Where you can go away and learn that and then bring it home.
Thanks for the call to Radio Times, Carmen. Go ahead.
Well, I don't know a lot about macrobiotics. The foods I know that are macrobiotic are very healthy foods. And actually, one of the bakers I worked with is a macrobiotic baker, and his whole philosophy of baking comes out of macrobiotics, one of the tenets of which is to thoroughly cook everything. And the brilliance of bread, you have a really wet dough, which is what you should have, I mean, so wet you can barely handle it, is that it leads to a lot of steam in the baking and a thorough cooking of the starches and the glutens, which makes it all much more digestible. A lot of people who have gluten problems don't if they have a properly fermented and properly cooked loaf of bread, which is something we should pay attention to.
And macrobiotics also believe in chewing everything.
That's right. Thorough mastication.
Thorough mastication,
yes. And,
exactly.
And that's probably a good idea, if only because it slows us down. Anything to make us eat more slowly than we do. The slower you eat, the more time your body has to recognize when you're full. It takes about 20 minutes for the stomach to notify the brain you're full. And most of us have eaten too much before that 20 minutes has elapsed. So, yeah, thorough chewing is probably a very good idea. So I think the principles are good. I think it's a kind of ascetic regime for some people. My guess is people have very good health results on it. The less meat in the diet, basically, we know people are healthier. Doesn't mean you have to abstain completely. Flexitarians are actually quite healthy too. On the cooking lesson question, I think there's no better way to learn than from another human. It's very hard to learn certain techniques from books, at least if you're me. I mean, you know, I remember studying charts on how to diaper a baby in a book, and it's like, ah. But, you know, one person
doesn't compute.
Doesn't compute. And the same with folding dough or any number of techniques in the kitchen. You know, when are the onions done? When have you finished sautéing? If you do it with someone who knows and they said that's what you're looking for, that level of translucence, you'll never have to question yourself again. And it's very hard to get that from a book, no matter how good the writer is. So classes are great, but even more simply, if you have a friend, someone in your circle who's really good, say, at making soups or baking bread, ask if you can come over and help sometime. People are flattered by the suggestion and happy to show you. And my guess is in your circle, you will find all sorts of skills that people would be very happy to share with you, and it won't cost you a dime.
Carmen, thanks for the call to Radio Times. Have you ever chewed brown rice 100 times?
I
remember
no.
trying. I got through about 25.
Really? 100 times is a lot of
time.
It
is a lot of time.
Well, that was Horace Fletcher, right? The great masticator from the 19th century advised this. And he lived, you know, to be I forget what. And he could run up and down the Washington Monument a couple times without panting. So.
Well, I'm not going to try it, but let me ask you about bread, because that's the air part of this book. You call baking the carpentry of cooking.
That's,
I like that.
I was intimidated because it seemed like that. It seemed like, compared to cooking, which had this margin of error, it did seem like architecture or carpentry. It had to be
things
really
had to work
precise.
Out, right?
Yeah, and you know, you had to buy a scale, calibrate it in grams. That was really, you know, metric. I mean, that was really intimidating. And baker's math is very intimidating too. They have a whole system for writing recipes that's different than anyone else on the planet. But as I learned how to do it, and again, working side by side with somebody, I realized you could throw all that out and trust your senses. That once you understood what you were going for in dough, you could tell when it was getting billowy and properly fermented. You could smell the changes in your starter and know whether your starter was healthy or needed to be fed. You could taste how sour the dough had gotten and whether it was time to stop the fermentation and put it in the oven. So it turns out to be less like carpentry than I thought and more like gardening.
Which you do, right?
Which I do, and I'm much more comfortable with. And gardening is not for precision types. You know, it's a dialogue, and there's plenty of adjustment. And if something dies, you just kind of, you know, throw it out and start again. It's not like – I mean, I wrote a book about architecture, and you make a mistake in your foundation, and you're screwed for the rest of the history of the building. So as it turns out, baking is more forgiving than I thought and much more to my liking than I expected.
Let me see what John from Berwyn has to say. John, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Yes, I'm calling because for about the last year and a half, my family has gone to cooking strictly at home every single meal. We eat out perhaps once a month. And what we have found is for my wife and I, who are, you know, healthy people to begin with, we just lost a tremendous amount, more weight, just by, you know, controlling the ingredients ourselves. And the second thing that we learned is about the, I guess, misconception that going out is going to add to, eating at home is going to add to more time. What we found is, you know, going out, ordering the food, waiting in line, adds to about, you know, 35, 40 minutes by the time you're able to eat that food. I mean, you can make a meal in 30 minutes or less every single day.
Well, John, I appreciate it.
That's a great point.
Yeah, thanks for the call. Go ahead.
And in fact, in the book, I did an experiment one night. We all got microwavable entrees at Safeway, and not even counting the shopping time, it took us 40 minutes to get them on the table. Because the microwave is the ultimate in individualistic appliances. It's the Ayn Rand of appliances. And, you know, so you have to, you can only do one portion at a time. So by the time my wife's lasagna came out, my son's onion soup was cold and he had to re-nuke it. And we never got to really sit down together. People have to re-examine how much convenience and how much time is really saved by these products. I think you're absolutely right. And we never count the time waiting or driving, and we should. And the fact that you lost weight, I have to say I'm not surprised. No. What you did is you took back control of your diet. You were deciding how much sugar was in something or how much salt or how much fat. And we have to understand that corporations play on our cravings. They cook differently than humans do, in the sense that when your mom or your dad is cooking for you, they're manipulating your reward system in your brain, but they're playing with the endorphin system. They're trying to satisfy you. Corporations are playing with your dopamine system. They're all about cravings. And that's why they love salt, fat, and sugar. They can manipulate our cravings with that. They want us to eat without end. And so it's very hard to control your intake of calories if you're letting corporations cook for you.
John, thanks for the call to Radio Times. But since we are in a restaurant town or even restaurant region, I mean, and there are wonderful places to go out to eat. And you can also go to the supermarket and buy all those industrialized foods. It's not just
eating. Yeah, it's not restaurant.
I mean, you can open a can.
That's right. Well, look, there are also processed foods that are the basis of good cooking. And we should make a distinction between what I call ultra-processed food or hyper-processed food, which is to say with, you know, 10 or 20 ingredients meant to be an entire meal, and then processed ingredients like a can of tomatoes, which I think is a mainstay of anybody's kitchen. But take a look at the difference between the ingredients on a can of tomatoes and a bottle of tomato sauce. Even though those two things look the same, they're completely different products. And the bottle of tomato sauce is going to have a ton of sugar and a ton of salt and a bunch of other chemicals. And the canned tomato is going to have one or two ingredients. So I use that. I use frozen spinach. I don't just do farmer's market organic cooking. I mean, I do, you know, practical cooking. And so there is a place for what you can get in the supermarket. Increasingly, supermarkets are moving toward whole meals. And I don't think that's a very healthy trend.
Thanks for the call to Radio Times. You can call as well. And again, that phone number, 1-888-477-9499. Michael Pollan is our guest today on the show, author of a new book called Cooked, A Natural History of Transformation. Much more after this very short break. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
Supporting WHYY, Camp Hill Special School with day and residential options is a community committed to the care and education of children ages 4 through 21 with mild to severe intellectual disabilities. Camp Hill's curriculum includes music, art, drama, the sciences, life and social skills development, animal husbandry, and horticulture. Camp Hill Special School is hosting an open house at their Chester County campus on April 27th. Details at camphillspecialschool.org.
I'm Marty Moscow-Wayne. Why do you listen to Radio Times? Because you're curious and you want to stay informed about our ever-changing world. Well, we are too, and that's why this show covers the gamut and has the time to devote to each issue. Today, it's a conversation with Mohsen Hamid, a Pakistani novelist who's having a very good year, followed by an interview with best-selling writer Michael Pollan. What's that worth to you? 1-888-345-9499 or pledge online at whyy.org. Thanks.
Princeton Medicine proudly supports WHYY. Princeton Medicine brings together primary care physicians, specialists, and surgeons from throughout central New Jersey, all on staff at Princeton Healthcare System to help provide greater access and coordinated care. Their specialties range from cardiology and geriatrics to cancer care, obstetrics and gynecology, and more. To find a Princeton Medicine doctor, 1-800-FIND-ADR or online at findadr.com.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen. If you're just joining us, Michael Pollan is our guest, author of a new book called Cooked, A Natural History of Transformation. He's written a bunch of other books about food, including Food Rules and Defense of Food, The Omnivore's Dilemma, and he's the Knight Professor of Journalism at Berkeley. And we're taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. You have a whole section in this book about microbes and fermentation, but I just wanted to read to our listeners or something that you write about your mom, again. My mother instilled a deep fear of molds, trichinosis, botulism, and other countless other unnamed germs possibly lurking in our food. Do you think that was something about her or the time that we lived in?
It was the time. This was the height of the war on bacteria, which is, you know, not over by any means. But hygiene was a big concern, and we had all the antimicrobials in the house. And and if a can was dented, even if it was dented because it had fallen on the floor, she was sure it had botulism, and we couldn't eat it. And
I lived in the opposite house. All we had were dented cans that were discounted at the supermarket.
Well, one of the things we're learning is that we probably should be exposing ourselves and our kids in particular to more bacteria, not less. And one of the reasons we're struggling with allergy and asthma and all these autoimmune conditions may have to do with the fact that we've over-sanitized our world. And I got acquainted in this working on fermentation, which, of course, is cooking without the use of heat, using bacteria mostly and fungi to make your food. Mm. And what an amazing idea that you can, you know, just dice a cabbage, say, salt it and bruise it with your fingers and put it in a crock, and within a day this will be bubbling away. And within a week, it will have been transformed. And you didn't even introduce the bacteria. They were there lurking on the leaves. So I spent a lot of time looking at the fermentations that take place outside our body and then in turn at the one that takes place in our body. And it may well be that fermentation, the internal fermentation happening in your large intestine, is one of the keys to your health. Wow. And one of the earmarks of the Western diet, you're only about 10% human, right? And you're 90% microbes. I know, it's kind of a mind-bending concept. The problem is Western food, the Western diet, feeds only the 10%. It's been processed to be readily absorbed sugars and fats that you absorb in your small intestine. And we leave nothing, very little fiber, very little plant matter for the microbes in your gut, and that's what they like to ferment. And the byproducts of that fermentation are critical to human health. And they're involved in everything from regulating our appetite to regulating our immune system. And the byproducts of those fermentations make you feel full and nourish the gut wall, which is tied to inflammation. It's an exploding area in science, and I think we're going to learn that you can actually garden this microbiome by eating properly. And so the question is, well, how do you feed those bugs?
Exactly.
And, if you're cooking, you're probably feeding them fine because you're not eating a lot of processed food. They don't like processed food, as it turns out, because processed food hasn't been processed with them in mind. The traditional foods that people have been eating for thousands of years do. And basically lots of plants, lots of fiber, lots of whole grain. It's everything you've been told. That's what they really like to eat. And they like fermented food. And so that yogurt,
pickles
yogurt, kimchi, sauerkraut, all these foods have three things that the gut likes. One is lots of bacteria, which either some of them take up residence, others just kind of stimulate the immune system, and others help heal the gut wall. But then there's tons of fiber in these fermented foods, not in the yogurt so much, but in the fermented vegetables. And then there's lots of lactic acid too, which is also very good for the gut. So I've learned to, you know, when I'm cooking, to think, you know, am I feeding the 100 trillion?
Think like a fermento, right?
Exactly. Think like a fermento.
Let me get, looks like Chris from Doylestown to join us on Radio Times. And Chris, go ahead. You're on the air.
Hi.
Hi there.
Pleasure to chat with you, Michael.
Nice.
Hi. I love your books.
Thank you.
Regarding farmers markets, it seems like we're getting a lot of kickback from possibly lobbyists that support the grocery stores that are trying to get rules that are going to shut the farmers markets down and really inhibit, like, you know, we'll have to package everything in clamshells and whatnot. And it's under the guise of food safety, but I don't really think it's that.
Are you
thoughts about it.
And Chris, I'm just curious, are you a food market purveyor?
I'm a forager. I forage wild mushrooms, ramps, fiddleheads, and I sell them at farmers markets.
And you feel like there are more rules and regulations for what you're selling?
Yeah, starting with Act 106 last year before, and then now it's they're talking. The FDA has got a new one out there. It's up for review now. It hasn't been passed into law yet, but it looks like it's going to go that way.
Oh, yeah, there's a real initiative to crack down on food safety, and the I think the inspiration for it though is basically the problems in the industrial food system, and that we have seen increased problems with E. coli and Salmonella in big commercial plants. The problem is that regulations are written one size fits all. And the kind of regulation you might need, say, in a chicken plant that's slaughtering, 200 birds a minute. I mean, some of these lines are incredibly fast. Are very different than what you need in a situation where a farmer is slaughtering 100 chickens in a day. Yet they come under the same rules. And that is a big problem because these small growers simply can't take those kind of steps. So we have to figure out a way to regulate food safety, which I do think we need to regulate, in ways that don't discriminate against small purveyors who are, in all likelihood, doing a very careful job. We're trying to regulate carelessness on an industrial scale, and it isn't fair that artisans should have to suffer under the same regime. But how you do it is it's easier said than done. I am concerned that we'll lose things like raw milk cheeses, and we'll lose things like wild foods, which are incredibly healthy. And I'm also concerned that there's an effort to remove animals from farms where vegetables are being grown because of the fear of E. coli. The most sustainable farms in the world have animals and plants. So there's some real there's a real misfit between the nature of biology on a well-run farm and the imperatives of industrial food production. And that war is going to be joined soon. And so I share your concerns.
Chris, thanks for the call to Radio Times. One more person I want to ask you about, Sister Marcelino.
Oh, Sister Noella.
She's the cheesemaker, yes?
Yeah, she's the cheese nun. She's a nun in Bethlehem, Connecticut, who I met. She's also she has a PhD in microbiology. And she's making a traditional cheese from the Auvergne. It's like a Saint-Nectaire. And she's doing it in the most traditional way. I mean, talk about food safety. She's making cheese in a wooden barrel. The FDA would just have conniptions about this.
Do they know about her?
I think they do, or at least the local health authorities do, because they tried to close her down and said, you've got to go to stainless steel. And she said, I am convinced it's safer this way. Now, a wooden barrel you cannot sterilize. There's just no way. And in fact, the traditional instructions are you just rinse it out lightly with water. You don't even try to sterilize it. But she proved to them by running an experiment where she inoculated two batches of milk, one in stainless steel, raw milk, one in her wooden barrel. She deliberately put E. coli in it. And after a couple hours, she measured it. And there were tons of E. coli in the stainless steel. It had gone crazy. In the wooden barrel, the levels were vanishingly small. Why is that? Because the lactobacillus that lived in the wood produced acid. They're lactic. They eat lactose and produced acid, and that killed the E. coli. So you realize these traditional food makers are practicing a kind of folk microbiology for hundreds of years that was keeping them safe, and we're screwing with it. And so that, we think stainless steel is so hygienic, but maybe not so much.
She's a very quotable nun, I have to say. Sister Noelle, one of the things she says is, I never did understand why cheese wasn't included in the Eucharist. And then she also says, cheese forces you to contemplate death, and confronting our mortality is a necessary part of spiritual growth.
Isn't that amazing?
It is.
Yeah, she really thought we should add cheese, maybe replace bread in the Eucharist with cheese, because it was, what a symbol of flesh, right? I mean, and in fact, cheese smell like flesh too. And she was willing to discuss with me, which very few food makers are happy to do. But in fact, there is an erotics to disgust in certain foods, and cheese, a stinky cheese, is a big part of it. And what she told me, which blew my mind, was that the bacteria that makes a stinky cheese stinky, Brevibacterium linens, B. linens, is very closely related to the bacteria that lives on your body and ferments your perspiration and gives humans their scent. So it's not just metaphorical when the French said that a great cheese has the pied de Dieu, it smells like the feet of God. What a weird idea too, right?
Yeah.
Foot odor and cheese odor do have this interesting relationship.
Talk about disgust, right?
Yeah.
Now, did you try her cheese?
Yes. In fact, I had a book party on Thursday night, and we served it. And it's a beautiful cheese. Yeah, it's a great cheese. And she was a wonderful person to run into, and she was a great teacher too. And a lot of cheesemakers, so concerned about food safety, would not let me touch their milk and get my hands dirty. Not dirty, but get my hands in there. She did. She was happy to have me make cheese side by side, and that was a thrill.
Let me get back to our callers. Looks like we have Gordon from Doylestown joining us on Radio Times. Gordon, go ahead. You're on the air.
Yeah. Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
You're very welcome.
Love your story today. The one thing that I've been wondering about as I see people not having time to make lunches for their kids to go to school or cook dinner or breakfast or what have you, is the disturbing trend of packaging playing into fast foods and things like Lunchables and McDonald's coming off as being so healthy with these wraps, but they're putting these little beautiful little jewel containers, and then the jewel containers get thrown out. Where is that leading to our environmental, responsibility here? And, certainly the garbage that we're putting in our body eating that food too.
Thanks for the call. They don't call it packaged food for nothing. I mean, there is an incredible amount of packaging that comes with this food, and McDonald's kind of started it, with food, hamburgers that were wrapped and then put in a box. I mean, what is this about? It was creating this illusion of a present. You were giving your kids a little Christmas present, whenever you took them to McDonald's. And when I mentioned earlier about the microwave meal that we had at home, this experiment, one of the most striking things about it was the sheer quantity of trash that was left at the end, bags and boxes. And I think it's a tremendous problem. It's an environmental problem. It's an equity problem. Do you know today in America that the farmer receives less of your average food dollar than the person making the package? Only about 8 cents of your food dollar reaches the farmer. 92 cents is reaching everybody else, and the person making the box or the bag is doing better than the farmer. There's something wrong with that picture.
Indeed, and that's Michael Pollan, our guest today on Radio Times. He's the Knight Professor of Journalism at Berkeley. He's written a number of books about food, and we're talking about his new book about cooking. It's called Cooked, A Natural History of Transformation. And I'm Marty Moscowane, and you're listening to Radio Times here on WHYY. Let me ask you about Michelle Obama. And she certainly has talked about getting fit and eating fresh and having a garden at the White House. Do you think – is there more that you want her to say about cooking per se?
I think it would be great if she talked about cooking. I think she has a little problem talking about cooking in that she doesn't do it.
She doesn't have to.
Well,
right?
Yeah, she has a superb chef, and she's a very busy person, and it's pretty rare that people in the White House do their own cooking for that period of time. But I think she appreciates the importance of it. Her chef, in fact, Sam Cass, is a great advocate for home cooking and does a lot to promote that himself. I think the power of first ladies is to change the culture, not to change policy so much. Lady Bird Johnson really changed our attitudes about littering and billboards and had an effect on the American landscape. And it seemed kind of small, but in fact, it's profound. You take a social norm like tossing stuff out the window of your car. A lot of people aren't old enough to remember when that was acceptable. And she changed that. And I think Michelle Obama has started the process of trying to change the culture of food in this country by going to farmers markets, planting a garden, talking about real food. But I also feel that her message has been somewhat diluted because her other initiative has been to negotiate tweaks in processed food. And I understand why she's doing that. And once the food industry comes to you and they say, we want to help, you can't, as First Lady, tell them to get lost. And suddenly you're drawn into a conversation about salt levels in processed food, the net effect of which, I think, is to legitimize that kind of eating. And I think it's a byproduct of what she's doing that is somewhat diluting the wonderful work she's doing in trying to change the food culture. If I were advising her, I would advise her to stay closer to the culture side of things and work on that. I could see the argument she's meeting people where they are. Most people are eating processed food. But she's got such an amazing microphone right now to change cultural norms, and that's really what we need to do. And cooking is right at the heart of it.
And we're almost out of time here. But would you say that the industrialized food system that we so rely on really is unsustainable as we look into the future, whether it has to do with land or air
or health
or
without question
global warming?
If we're still eating the same way and growing food the same way in 50 years, there will be a breakdown of one kind or another. I don't know what will happen first, but it could be that we'll be bankrupt as a government because of the cost of type 2 diabetes. That alone is when we talk about swamping the healthcare system with these rising costs, we're talking about chronic diseases, and most of these chronic diseases are linked to diet. Mm-hmm. They can be changed with a simple change in diet. And yes, so that's an unsustainable system if we can't afford to keep eating this way. And we can't afford to keep eating this way.
Well, Michael Pollan, always a pleasure. Thank you for joining us
today
in Radio Times. And the book is called Cooked, A Natural History of Transformation. He's also the author of a number of other books, bestsellers, The Omnivore's Dilemma in Defense of Food. And he's the Knight Professor of Journalism at Berkeley. Go to whyy.org/Radio Times to find out much more about this program. Kevin Griffin, the engineer for today's edition of the show, produced by Susan Greenbaum, Patty McMahon, and Debbie Builder, with assistance from Emily Bryant. I'm Marty Moscowane. Thank you so much for joining us.